next case, which is case number 58810, Lori Bush versus Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and also Las Vegas Police Protective Association. We have Mr. Marks and Mr. Levine here on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Collins, and Mr. Crosby, and I see Mr. Eccles here too on behalf of the respondents. So, also for the record, Chief Justice Pickering is recused from participating further in this case. Mr. Levine, if you proceed.
Yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
This case arises from the denial of a petition for judicial review and denial of a declaratory judgment action in the district court. The petition for judicial review, of course, was review of a final order of the EMRB. There are two claims, one against the union, the Police Protective Association, and one against the department. I'd like to start with the issues relating to the union.
Can I have you do something first? There's been an allegation that this, or there's been representation that this is moot, that the written reprimand has been purged from the file, and therefore there's, you're asking us to decide essentially an abstract question. There's no case in controversy here anymore.
Yes, I would be delighted to address that.
Do that first.
Foremost, the mootness argument was made by the department, not the PPA, the union. I don't believe there is a claim of mootness as it relates to the union. The claim of mootness we do not believe to be accurate as it relates to the employer, because the purging of the written reprimand was pursuant to contract, pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement, whereby discipline is removed depending on the severity of the discipline after a number of years. And in City of Reno versus Reno Police Protective Association, and there are actually three cases between those two parties. I'd like to distinguish between the 86 case and the 2002 case. I'm referring to the 2002 case. This court held that issues of contract interpretation are separate from the issues of whether an unfair labor practice has occurred. In that particular case, notwithstanding the determination of an arbitrator, the court found a violation, a unilateral change due to a change in the criteria used by the Reno Police Department to address off-duty misconduct, and the court recognized that the two are separate and distinct. An unfair labor practice is complete and occurs when it happens and is not dependent upon what happens with the discipline later. There are very important, significant results to an officer during those two-year period. They're not eligible for promotion if they have a written reprimand. More significantly, in a case of political discrimination, which we allege in this case, and the EMRB found that we presented evidence sufficient to raise such an inference, that written reprimand, that discipline, is going to be used in a political campaign in that during 2 years. And in fact, was in this case. When Lori Bush goes in front of John Ralston to be interviewed with the other potential candidates, she's being questioned upon this. And I think finally, when it goes to the issue of mootness, this is a classic case of capable of repetition but avoiding review. By the time a case works its way through the district court and ultimately makes its way to this court, more likely than not, 2 years is going to have passed, and you would then have the potential for the department to be able to conduct unlawful labor practices over and over and over, confident that the discipline will be contractually removed before the issues raised can be analyzed by this court. So on those grounds, I would assert that the matter is not moot.
Thank you.
In January of 2009, Lori Bush, who at the time was a 16-year veteran of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, was served with a notice of internal investigation. This was done after the assistant sheriff violated internal affairs confidentiality and leaked false information to the Health and Welfare Trust, suggesting that Officer Bush had committed insurance fraud. By the time the notice was sent, was given to Officer Bush, the Health and Welfare Trust had concluded and informed the department that, in fact, no, there was no fraud. This was all unknown to Lori Bush at the time, but she was nevertheless served with a notice of internal investigation. And what she did was she requested representation from her union. She asked Chris Collins, the president, to be present with her, and Collins agreed to do so. When she showed up at internal affairs, she also elected to exercise her statutory right under NRS 289080 to have a second representative of her own choosing present at the interview. She selected attorney John Moran Jr. to go with her.
Well, you're entitled to have both your own private attorney and the PPA representative.
289.080 specifically states that an officer may have two representatives of their own choosing. In the language of their own choosing.
Doesn't that go to the board not being able to exclude another additional representative as opposed to a right or entitlement to have two representatives present?
No. And because the language of their own choosing is actual language that arises out of National Labor Relations Board versus Weingarten. The language, a representative of your own choosing, is language taken from Weingarten, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, which recognizes that the right to have a union representative present is inherent in the language mutual aid and protection, the concept of mutual aid and protection. And the courts have held that the Weingarten right to designate a representative of your own choosing belongs to the employee, not the union, and certainly not the employer. Lori Bish already had a right pursuant to Weingarten to have a union representative there. She then elected under 289.080 to exercise her statutory right to have a second representative of her own choosing present. The statute is rendered meaningless. It is illusory. If a union may refuse to represent one of its members under its obligation of mutual aid and protection simply because the peace officer chooses to bring a second representative, which is their statutory right. You can't have two representatives of your own choosing from among the categories of union representatives.
The union's policy, though, not to provide an additional representative if there was counsel, private counsel retained, and it was nothing particular in this case, was it?
It was not particular in this case. That was their stated, it was in one of their bylaws. However, first and foremost, a bylaw cannot supersede a statute. In fact, as I think I pointed out in the briefs and in the record, the bylaws themselves say they are to be subordinate to the laws of the United States and the state of Nevada. 289.080 is obviously a law of the state of Nevada, and the Weingarten right has been long established. In other words, you cannot, by passing a bylaw, circumvent the requirements of 289.080, which speak in terms of the officers, representatives of their own choosing.
But you can't argue then that the union acted arbitrarily, discriminatorily, or in bad faith.
Oh, I certainly
in this
can.
Case.
Oh, yes, I can.
Based upon that particular failure to provide representation?
The failure to provide representation in violation of law is certainly arbitrary, okay? Whether they do it to everybody, whether they violate the law in every instance, doesn't render it any less arbitrary or capricious. The law is clear on its face, which is that the officer has a right to two representatives of their own choosing, and if a union can say, well, if you exercise your statutory right, we will not represent you. Not only have they violated the obligation of mutual aid and protection, which is at the heart of Weingarten, but they have also rendered the statute illusory. It's meaningless. Under what circumstance could a peace officer have a union representative and a lawyer of their own choosing? And again, those words are in the statute and from Weingarten. Under what circumstances could you ever have that if the union had a right to say, pursuant to our bylaws, we're not going to represent you? Statutes are to be construed in a manner which are to render them enforceable. In fact, in the only published decision from this court addressing the Peace Officers Bill of Rights, Chapter 289, the case of City of North Las Vegas, Ruiz versus City of North Las Vegas, in footnote 9, this court specifically determined that even notwithstanding the statutory language, those statutes must be construed in a manner to make them enforceable and to provide the rights to the peace officers. And I think that footnote 9 would dispense with any, Ruiz would dispense with any issue as to whether or not a union could render the protections of the statute illusory or missing.
Mr. Lee, can you talk a little bit about the political motivation issue with the sheriff and the campaigns and all, and how that
Yes, absolutely.
Happens?
The evidence was that Assistant Sheriff Ray Flynn violated Internal Affairs confidentiality, which was very important, conceded to be very important, by leaking false information. The evidence was undisputed that Internal Affairs went forward even after learning that there was no insurance fraud. The evidence produced at the hearing was that once a very courageous sergeant, Sergeant Romaine, was assigned to the case, he refused to go forward and terminate Lori Bish, as he had been instructed to do, because basically the charges, you know, his words were, the language he used in front of the EMRB were chicken poop. It just didn't make any sense. The evidence given in testimony under oath from Sergeant Romaine was that he, Lieutenant Les Lane, and the captain all agreed this warranted only a contact report. Yet he was overruled by a higher-up that was never produced, who never testified at the EMRB, and with their collective judgment, which had to have come from the deputy chief, assistant sheriff, or sheriff, that higher level, overruled their collective judgment and imposed, notwithstanding, a written reprimand in any event. Now,
when did this happen in conjunction with the 2010 campaign?
It was prior to the campaign, but the testimony established before the EMRB that Officer Bish had run in 2006, and it was established that the department knew, and Assistant Sheriff Ray Flynn knew, that she was going to be running again in 2010. So they knew she would be running. And when it came to the issue of political discrimination, the EMRB made an error of law. They found that the evidence presented to them was sufficient to raise an inference of political discrimination. However, the EMRB then applied the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting analysis and concluded, well, the department has asserted a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and Officer Bish has not proven pretext and been ruled against her. The problem with that analysis is that the McDonnell-Douglas test has been held not to be applicable where there is direct evidence of discrimination. The U.S. Supreme Court has said you don't apply the burden shifting and the pretext requirement in that context. Also, the EMRB's decision cited the First Circuit's analysis for political discrimination in the Padilla-Garcia case, but it didn't actually follow the Padilla-Garcia analysis, because Padilla-Garcia says that when you put on evidence of political discrimination, the burden shifts to the employer to demonstrate they would have taken the same action anyway, and pretext is not required. And if you look at the record before the EMRB, you will see that the department did not produce any evidence or any witnesses to come in with admissible evidence and testify that they would have done the same thing anyway, but for the political aspirations. They produced nobody to testify that, yes, they would have leaked internal affairs for anybody else, notwithstanding Lori Bish running for office. They did not produce anybody to testify that they would continue an internal affairs investigation even after they knew the underlying charges was false. And they did not produce anybody to come in and explain why the collective judgment of her immediate chain of command, her captain, her lieutenant, and her sergeant, who all concluded a contact report was appropriate, why that was overruled. So the department did not even carry its burden under any analysis to come forward and demonstrate that they would have taken the same action anyway so as to rebut an allegation of political discrimination. I think I'm going to reserve my remaining time.
Thank you very much. Are the respondents going to divide their time up? Or?
Yeah,
okay, Ms. Collins, you can tell me what the division is.
I will. Kathy Collins, on behalf of the Police Protective Association, I will be addressing the issues that have been raised as to the union. But Mr. Carlton is going to address the issues raised as to the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and we're splitting our time evenly. So I hope that I will conclude, leaving him 7.5 minutes precisely.
Okay. Very well. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Kathy Collins on behalf of the PPA. The issue in this case is whether the Police Protective Association breached its duty of fair representation to Officer Bish when it did not represent her in the internal affairs interview that took place in January of 2009. The appellant in this case has confused this issue by intermingling a totally unrelated and different standard, that being the duty, the right to representation, which stems from the National Labor Relations Act here in this state, NRS 289, and has been discussed in a number of cases, perhaps most notably the NLRB versus Wingarden case. However, NRS 289 does not apply to labor organizations such as the PPA, and as a result, it cannot be deemed to impose a duty on the part of the PPA to represent officers in all circumstances. This issue, this 289 issue, is a question that the EMRB and the district court looked at in different fashions. But being as it's an issue of statutory interpretation, this court does not need to give deference to the EMRB and looks at it de novo. NRS 289, again, in particular the Peace Officer Bill of Rights, it simply cannot be read as applying to labor organizations. The Peace Officer Bill of Rights, which is 289.020 through 289.120, places limitations on a law enforcement agency. In other words, it sets forth, and if you look at each one of the provisions, they either set forth an obligation on the part of an agency or a limitation on the part of an agency, which here is the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. So if you look at it in the context of this particular situation, NRS 289.020, as this court pointed out earlier, what it speaks to is that a law enforcement agency, and here the investigators in the internal affairs, could not limit Officer Bish to just one representative. It does not and cannot be read to place an affirmative obligation on the part of the Police Protective Association.
Does the union ever represent police officers when there's private training involved?
The union has never done so. As pointed out to the EMRB, evidence was presented, substantial evidence presented to the EMRB, that this practice has been uniformly and consistently enforced throughout time, both as to situations before Officer Bish's and situations after. So in each and every single case where the same request has been made, that the PPA come in and do a dual representation with private counsel, the officer has been given the same information, that that's prohibited by the bylaw, that it's not a practice of the PPA, and in fact, is if you've looked at the cases that were submitted, in each and every one of those circumstances, the employee in question either chose to go with the private attorney or chose to go with the union, but in not a single other case was there dual representation such as sought here.
Is there what's the policy though for that?
The policy is it is not unusual in particular in internal affairs for an officer to receive conflicting advice from a private attorney and the PPA representative. One specific comes to mind, which is with regard to Garrity. It's not unusual for an attorney to advise an officer not to respond to certain questions and to assert their Fifth Amendment. The PPA, on the other hand, understanding Garrity protections apply, would likely advise the officer to provide information in that internal affairs setting. So my understanding is historically it created controversy and issues for the employee, and so the decision was made that in those circumstances, the employee, and certainly the employee, is never left without representation. There's always an assurance that the employee does have representation in those circumstances. It's just to avoid the conflict and controversy that arises from the dual representation.
Well, in this particular case, there was actually a representative there and then wanted to be there to make sure the private counsel did show up.
And that's exactly right. And that is in large part part of the decision of the EMRB as to why this particular matter did not violate the duty of fair representation, because in this particular case, Detective Collins was there. He was not sure whether Officer Bish had in fact retained Attorney John Moran, and so he showed up there out of an abundance of caution and only left when he saw that Officer Bish did arrive with an attorney, and the attorney was her choice to that was her choice to have him represent her in that particular hearing.
Did this court, in their estimation, leave the door open in footnote 9 in the Ruiz opinion to extend to the union the duties that are placed on the employer under the Peace Officers Act?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. You know, again, the language of 289 is clear. Again, it's a Bill of Rights that imposes restrictions on an employer. And I would just point out that in this particular case, even if this court determines, you know, whether it determines that the language is clear or the language is not clear, if you look at the legislative history of the change in this particular case, it's further proof that the legislature intended just what I am arguing here today. In other words, the history shows, and it was Ron Greer who testified before the legislature, and he talked about how the purpose of that statute and the purpose of the changes that were submitted was to level the playing field. Historically, what had happened in these interviews was internal affairs would show up with two or three, sometimes even as many as four or five interrogators, yet the employee was limited to just one representative. And that was the purpose of the change, was that the employer could not limit the employee to just one representative, and that he or she could bring up to two in a particular hearing.
But how can the objectives of the statute be effectuated? That is, the officer's right to choose two representatives to be present if the union, by contract with the employer, circumvents that requirement.
I would just note that the language about of their choosing speaks again to a restriction on the part of the employer. So if you look at the case of Weingarten, or some of the more recent cases, the Anheuser-Busch case that appellant cites in her brief, those cases, when they discuss the issue of their own choosing that particular language, the factual scenarios are, in particular in Anheuser-Busch, the employee wanted to bring a particular union representative. The employer said, no, that person's unavailable. You have to bring this representative instead. So the of your own choosing language discusses, again, a limitation on the employer, not something the employer is entitled to.
The context of those cases are dealing with disputes between the employer and the employee.
And that's precisely
not in the context of a dispute between the employee and the union.
And that's precisely the point, because Weingarten and this statute all place restrictions on the employer, not a labor organization. I see that I have exceeded my time. If the court has any other questions, I'll let Mr. Crosby speak.
Thank you very much. Mr. Crosby, appearing on behalf of Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department.
Mm-hmm. May it please the court, Nick Crosby on behalf of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Thank you, Your Honors. There is nothing in the record I propose to this court that warrants second-guessing the MLB's decision based upon the facts presented over a two-day hearing with 49 exhibits. I first want to touch on the mootness issue the court raised with counsel. This matter has been purged from Officer Bish's file. There is no opportunity or ability for the department to use that written reprimand.
What about the point Mr. Levine made that maybe John Ralston or somebody like that in political commentators can still use that against Ms. Bish if she was going to be run for elected office in the future?
Well, the interesting thing in that, Your Honor, is that both Officer Bish as well as Sergeant Romaine at the MRB hearing testified that the factual allegations contained in the adjudication of complaint, the final adjudication of complaint, were all factually accurate, every single word in that adjudication. So an inquiry from a person such as John Ralston or anyone else about the facts leading up to a written reprimand were all factually accurate. They were not false. They happened. And that's something that seems, in my opinion, the MRB got right in that it weighed the evidence and found that misconduct did occur in this
case. Well, I guess the issue here is, in that regard, the range of discipline might have changed depending on the media. I mean, the argument that there was political motivation here certainly would weigh on the range of discipline that was imposed, wouldn't it?
Well, not necessarily for the department. The political discrimination aspect wouldn't have anything to do with the department based upon its investigation.
Well, when you've got statements in the record that indicate this is a tower caper, indicating that there was something from up high that was causing this investigation to be pursued in a particular manner?
Well, I'd like to note, on the tower caper, Sergeant Romaine is the only person who testified about the tower caper being, adding some sort of nefarious sheen to it.
Something the MRB picked up on.
They picked up that he
gave us some validity.
They did find that he said it was a tower caper, but if you look at the testimony of Detective Grimmett, who was in internal affairs for a much longer period of time than Detective Romaine, he was only in internal affairs, or Sergeant Romaine, I'm sorry, for 3 months, and that would have been prior to 2007, I believe. Detective Grimmett testified that tower capers refer to City Hall as being the tall building, and that it is, those are cases that appear on a daily activity report that the executive staff looks at when there are high-profile cases. An officer may be terminated based upon the allegations, because the department does have about 5 line items that will result in termination for a first offense. They are not cases that the executive staff, the sheriff, the undersheriff, or the assistant sheriffs are directing. They are cases that they want to keep abreast of, either because they're going to catch media attention, an officer is going to lose their job. They are high-profile cases. So I would advance to the court that the tower caper referenced by Sergeant Romaine, based upon Detective Grimmett's case, was really slang or jargon, if you will, and that the nefarious sheen added to it and picked up by the MRB was really not, it had nothing to do with political discrimination. And in fact, counsel noted, or counsel argued, that he believes this is a case of direct evidence for political discrimination. And I'll challenge the court, I'll challenge Mr. Levine, to show me direct evidence of political discrimination, essentially that Sheriff Gillespie or Sheriff Gillespie's executive staff directed this investigation to start. The record shows that Valentine Insana's mother lodged the complaint. And under Internal Affairs Policy 510.1.24, the department investigates all allegations. It didn't come from the department, so under the two investigation. What happened in the investigation as found by the MRB and shown on the record? It was alleged to be insurance fraud. That was dispelled. There was a comment or a conversation with a deputy district attorney regarding another felony crime, which under our department policy would be a terminal offense. What happened to that violation? It was removed after Sergeant Romaine brought it to the attention of labor relations. And that is the purpose of the review. That is why the chain of command looks at these. Not just the sergeant, but the lieutenant, the captain, the deputy chief, and when warranted, an assistant sheriff.
There was also recommendations for a verbal reprimand as opposed to a written reprimand, too.
There was discussion about a contact report, right, which is not discipline. But at the end of the day, the ultimate decision with this discipline under department policy does not lie with the bureau commander in all cases. The assistant sheriff, a deputy chief, or the sheriff can be the ultimate decision maker with respect to that discipline. In this case, if there truly was political discrimination, or these decisions were based on political bias or motivation, it would have been in the record, and Officer Bush may have been terminated, because that's originally how this started out. It didn't happen. She got the lowest form of discipline, and Your Honor mentioned, would the range of discipline be affected based upon the political discrimination? Officer Bush received the absolute lowest form of discipline this agency is allowed to provide, not being able to
had a contact.
A contact report is not discipline.
Right.
In order for a contact report to be issued, it would have had to make the department would have had to determine that the conduct that was sustained by internal affairs was not something that needed to be addressed with a written discipline. It's something that could be handled with a supervisory intervention. And in this case, let's look at what the facts we had. We had an officer who participated and helped manufacture a lie to an independent third-party medical provider for purposes of seeking treatment. Now, from the department's standpoint, it has an obligation based upon what the department does for a living and its employees. They're vested with great powers, and the department takes that very seriously and monitors its employees' actions both on and off duty, as stated in 510.2G, subsection 1 of the Department of Civil Service Rule. The department has to focus on it, and they have to monitor that, and when necessary, has to discipline it, because the public expects that from an agency. From an agency that wants to be transparent, like WMPD, that wants its officers to hold up to their core values, I care, integrity, respect, courage, accountability, or sorry, integrity, courage, accountability, respect for others, and excellence. It has to monitor this. What is the department to do when it finds sustained by clear and convincing evidence, as admitted, that someone went to a medical facility,
go ahead and finish your thought,
knowingly masquerading a juvenile for purposes of seeking treatment? What is the department to do? Because if it does nothing, then and it sends a message to that officer and other officers that this type of conduct is okay.
Counsel, the department created a moving target, so to speak, from where they started, and they had the same facts. And there's been within this an allegation that the facts have been manipulated and changed depending on who they were talking to, including the facts that were presented to the district attorney's office when the inquiry went forward. What is your response to that?
My response is that I think what came out, Your Honor, is allegations of facts, allegations of things that have occurred.
It was clear to an outsider that the way this was being conducted, the premise from the department is we have to get her for something because the charges kept changing along the way.
Now, if the department felt like it wanted to get her for something, it certainly, as the MRB noted, would have stuck with the recommendation from the district attorney's office for felony. That's a terminable charge.
Not the insurance fraud.
It would be under Chapter 205, which would be essentially obtaining the identity of another for purposes for your own use.
That doesn't quite fit, though, does it?
No, absolutely not. But if you think reasonably, if the department truly wanted to get Officer Bish and get her fired, under department policy, you do not need to be convicted of a felony to get fired.
How horribly risky that would be in any substantial issue.
Absolutely, and this is what we're looking at here, is we have admitted misconduct by an officer. She admits every fact in that adjudication ultimately came out of the investigation. Everything that was alleged, be it accurate or not, at the end of the day when it came out in the final wash, both her and Sergeant Lee admitted were 100% factually correct, and those are the facts that I recited to you a few minutes ago. And
Thank you very much.
Would it be fair to say that if firing wasn't the get her for something, that the political motivation, which is alleged, certainly without firing could have done what it was intended to do at the time?
I think in the hypothetical posed by the court or the suggestion posed by the court, I would be a fool to stand before this court and say that some negative comment could potentially have an impact on a candidate for running for the office of sheriff. But again, we have facts that have been sustained and are not denied. So what we're dealing with here is whether or not the department's decision to provide a written reprimand versus termination was improper. And in the labor realm, routinely management's decisions with respect to the appropriateness of discipline is left to the purview of management, provided that the facts leading up to the sustained misconduct have been adequately proven, which they've been admitted in this case.
I'm pretty comfortable with that's the question.
I see what Your Honor is pointing to, essentially, couldn't the department achieve this objective to damage Officer Bish's political career by simply giving a written reprimand? It didn't need to be a suspension or a demotion or a termination. But I'll note in the record, the direct evidence provided by the department was that the investigating detective, Detective Grimmett, never had a conversation with the sheriff, never had a conversation with Assistant Sheriff Flynn, never had a conversation with anybody, and he also stated that her political aspirations had absolutely nothing to do with his investigation. So he's the detective in charge of fact-finding. And that's the direct evidence. What we have on Officer Bish's side is speculation. We have facts that she's put together that the MRB found drew an inference. But ultimately, she did not carry the day in trial. Some of the cases cited were dealt with summary judgment.
I'm concerned about that analysis, Mr. Crosby, because the MRB decision said that the burden shifted to Metro to respond to the inferences. Where in the decision in the MRB do you feel that Metro responded to the inferences?
I think that Metro responded to the inferences, one, with respect to the policy 5101.24, which is the policy that all claims of misconduct are investigated. Initially, the MRB, the challenge was that this investigation was prompted by political discrimination. Mm-hmm. The facts proved that it was not. It was prompted by a citizen who did not care too much for the overall treatment, I believe is the exact statement, that her daughter received under Officer Bish's care. So the actual impetus of this case did not come from the department.
What about the other inferences, that the reporting information to the district attorney provided incorrect facts that caused the district attorney and the deputy district attorney to conclude erroneously that the facts constituted a crime, that repeated efforts were made to try to just dispose of this matter by Romaine, and instead there was an insistence that some discipline be required. I don't find in the EMRB findings and conclusions facts that refute those inferences.
Well, I think what the EMRB noted in the political discrimination aspect of the order is that the department did, as I stated, note that it will investigate all claims of misconduct. It also noted that the written policy, 510.2G, subsection 1, specifically states off-duty misconduct can be punishable. So what the EMRB did, and based upon the testimony and evidence, it was looked at the department will investigate all claims or allegations of misconduct, and that if it's sustained, our policy, or civil service rule in this case, 510.2, provides more than discipline for off-duty misconduct, provided that it tends to bring the department into public discredit, which renders the officer ineffective. The department weighed the evidence with respect to those elements and found that those were met, and therefore the department defeated or, you know, rebutted the inference of political discrimination by showing it followed all its policies. And we have no other evidence in the record that any other officer was ever treated differently under 510.2G. And in fact, you'll know when the Internal Affairs releases the sort of recap of cases that's in the record, and while they don't include the policy violations, the conduct unbecoming, there is an officer there who had an off-duty, non-criminal misconduct who was disciplined as well. And so the agency operates, does not operate to get officers in trouble. I know that's the allegation, but let's look to the facts in this case. There is no proof of political discrimination in this case. Officer Bush ultimately carries the burden at the end of the day, regardless of what standard, the McDonnell-Douglas standard or the Padilla-Garcia standard, which is essentially the Mount Healthy Relaxed Inference standard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crosby. Okay. Tracy, would you have 2 more minutes to Mr. Levine's time, since we have so many questions here to the respondents to kind of even this out?
Thank you. I would like to start with the issue of 510.2, and that went to the heart of the unilateral change case, which I didn't really have much of an opportunity to address when I first came up to speak with you. This court, in Stevens v. Hocker, approximately 25 years ago, recognized there was a constitutional problem with disciplining officers, and Hocker was a peace officer. That was a peace officer case, to off-duty misconduct for conduct that does not impact their ability to perform the job, on the job. And in Stevens v. Hocker, this court sidestepped, recognized the constitutional problem, but said we're not going to address it on constitutional grounds. We're going to require that language such as conduct unbecoming requires a nexus to the job.
And that was our, why wouldn't this have a very particular nexus to the job? These officers, all they really have when they're testifying, when they're making statements about crimes that have been committed, they've got their credibility.
Okay.
And credibility is very
important. Absolutely. But first and foremost, what Lori Bush did, failing to intervene when her daughter Lindsay said, "Thou have used my name," that's not actually a crime.
Say that again.
What Lori Bush did, failing to intervene when her daughter, who is an adult, Lindsay Bush, says, "Valentine can use my name," that's not a crime.
No. So she's standing there and representing this individual as her daughter?
Her testimony in front of EMRB was that it was Lindsay said she can use my name.
Okay. And she didn't say anything.
She did not say anything.
A misimpression, it's knowing not, that you're representing.
It's not actually a crime, but let's sidestep that issue. I understand what you're saying.
No, it's not a crime.
But the point is this, that the requirements to impose discipline for off-duty misconduct have two components. It must tend to bring the department into public discredit, and thereby tending to impair the officer's efficiency to perform their duties. And I took the deposition and had that read into the record at the EMRB proceeding of the deputy chief who denied the grievance contractually later. And he conceded, public didn't know about it, no discredit to the public, and he conceded it did not impair her operational efficiency. And that went to the heart of our unilateral change issue, because those two components are required. That essentially encompasses the nexus component, which this court addressed back in Stevens v. Hocker, the nexus to public employment. Officer Stevens in Stevens v. Hocker he was actually arrested in public for drunk and disorderly conduct with regard to a domestic dispute on his wife, and the court said, no, it doesn't impact his ability to perform his job. There was nothing about what Lori Bish did while she was out on medical leave after surgery that impacted her efficiency to perform her job, and that was conceded in the record by Deputy Chief Mark Joseph. And because the department eliminated that second component, tending to impair their efficiency, that is why we brought a unilateral change claim, because under the City of Reno versus Reno Police Protective Association, the 2002 case dealing with, in that case, it was the five-part Robertson criteria used by the City of Reno, when you change those criteria, you must bargain for it, and I got out evidence in the record before the EMRB that there was no such bargaining. Very, very quickly, under the burden-shifting analysis that was raised in questions to Mr. Crosby, the burden-shifting requires admissible evidence, not a statement of counsel, oh, we have to investigate all claims. There was no testimony, admissible evidence presented as to why internal affairs confidentiality was violated by Assistant Sheriff Flynn, who reported false accusations of fraud in violation of their confidentiality regulations. And then Mr. Crosby says, well, discipline isn't necessarily decided by the Bureau Commander, it's by the Assistant Sheriff or the Sheriff. They didn't produce a witness to testify admissibly as to why the collective judgment of Sergeant Romaine, Lieutenant Lane, and Captain O'Leary was overruled. They didn't even meet the second component of the burden-shifting analysis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Romaine. Any questions from any justice? Okay, thank you very much. The case will stand submitted. And